As National Poetry Month comes to an end, poetry lovers do have one more big moment this April, tomorrow's Poem in Your Pocket Day. The idea is to celebrate by tucking a favorite poem into your back pocket to share with family, friends, and coworkers. At Bagby's Gourmet Sandwiches in Charlottesville, Virginia, customers will find something different in their bag lunches. Owner John LaPanta explains.
Usually they get a chocolate chip cookie with their sandwich, but on Thursday they'll get a poem. And usually they don't know about it. They're like, what the heck is this? They open it up, and it's always the same expression. They read, they look at it again, and then they smile and look back at us and thank us.
In New York, Bikshni Weisbrod works at the UN. She'll be at the subway tomorrow, passing out poems by the late Sri Chinmoy, an Indian-born writer and peace activist.
I can give you an example of one. Just one smile immensely increases the beauty of the universe.
Teachers like Brenda Krupp in Pennsylvania will use Poem in Your Pocket Day to entice students into the world of verse.
Third graders do not have pockets that are easily accessible, so they actually sewed simple pockets that they will then wear on their T-shirt, and they're just going to be stuffed with poems they've written themselves, as well as some shorter poems that they just love.
My name is Dustin Johnson. I am a freshman English teacher at Choctaw High School in Oklahoma.
Johnson has asked each of his 90 students to bring a poem to class, a poem with special meaning to them.
We're going to go to our school's courtyard and use sidewalk chalk to write those poems on the concrete areas so that students from all over campus can come around and take a look at them.
Colleen Schaffroth is director of the Mary Hill Museum of Art in Washington State. She will have this Dorothy Parker verse on hand.
It's called Comment. Oh, life is a glorious cycle of song, a medley of extemporanea, and love is a thing that can never go wrong, and I am Marie of Romania.
Just a taste of tomorrow's Poem in Your Pocket Day. It will be 20 years ago on Sunday that Los Angeles went up in flames. And the man at the center of the L.A. riots is telling his story with new details. Rodney King was on parole, speeding, and under the influence when he refused to stop for police. That ended in a beating that made King famous. Rodney King has written about all this in a new memoir, and he spoke with NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
With a helicopter buzzing overhead, the videotape of his encounter with police is so famous, you could say Rodney King was beaten into American history. A year later, the acquittal of the four LAPD officers charged with beating King resulted in the worst riots in modern American history.
Good evening. The top news continues at the hour of 6 o'clock. The riots, the fires, the looting.
Well, the smell of smoke is everywhere this morning. But
white car has a driver in it, and that driver is dead.
While vast parts of L.A. were still smoldering, King stood on the steps of Los Angeles City Hall pleading for peace.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along?
That was May 1st, 1992, and King looked dazed and scared. Today, he looks alert and healthy. He's come in from his home in Rialto, an hour east of L.A., to talk about his new memoir, The Riot Within. In a small park within view of City Hall, King says his Can We Get Along speech was completely impromptu. His lawyers had drafted a far angrier script for him, but he refused to use it.
I couldn't see putting any more heat on the fire, you know? That's not the way I was raised.
As he recounts in his memoir, King was raised in Pasadena by his mother, Odessa, a devout Jehovah's Witness. Their congregation was multicultural, so King says he was really bothered by the post-verdict fury of some black rioters against non-blacks.
The way I was raised in my religion is we have to be able to get along with each other. That's your brother and sister. You can't threaten somebody in your household. America's my house.
Many people who felt King had been denied justice didn't appreciate that sentiment and told him so.
People were mad at me because they didn't think I was going to say, can we all get along? I had people come up to say, what the f*** did you say that for?
They wanted King to validate the riot's violence. He wouldn't. King insists he's not naive about race. He does allow that he's trying to figure out how to tell his small nephews that black men are especially vulnerable in certain situations.
It's that black talk. It's to get ready, you know, just be aware. Watch your surroundings.
It's advice he says he should have taken himself on the night he was beaten so badly. Two of the four policemen acquitted in 1992 were convicted in a federal trial a year later. King eventually received almost $4 million from the city of Los Angeles in a civil suit. He bought two modest homes, one for himself, one for his mother. But most of his settlement evaporated in a failed effort to establish a hip-hop record label and in a tangle of lawyer's fees. For years after the trials, a series of minor scrapes with the law ended King in and out of jail until he decided to do something about his alcoholism. Last year, he told CNN his battle against the bottle is ongoing.
Well, I always have an issue when it comes to alcohol. Well, my dad was alcoholic. The addiction part is in my blood.
King says he works every day to not give in to the urge, and his sobriety is a work in progress. His more sober life comes with happy fringe benefits. Last year, King became engaged to Cynthia Kelly, a former juror from his civil trial. He still gets requests from the police, but they're not assume-the-position requests.
For the most of it, out in San Bernardino County, Rodney, we need you to come and talk to these kids. We need you to do this, you know. Things have changed for me, you know.
Some things haven't. He's still instantly recognizable. He's still plagued with frequent nightmares and physical ailments from the beating, but he seems content. He enjoys babysitting for his grandchildren and nephews. On warm days, he surfs and goes fishing. And though he hopes he's years away from death, when Rodney King is asked if he's thought about what he'd like engraved on his headstone, he has a ready answer.
Can we all just get along? Can we all get along in peace?
Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin, and I am standing on the corner of 22nd and I Street, Northwest in Washington, D.C. We are on the campus of George Washington University, and we're out talking with 20-somethings about the expectations they have for their lives for the next few years. For many people, the 20s are a decade to explore, to investigate different options. In a few moments, we'll hear from Meg Jay. She's an author who's written a book called The Defining Decade, about how the 20s are far more important in terms of shaping our lives than we might think. We'll hear from her in a few minutes, but first, we wanted to talk with 20-somethings about what they're thinking about this time of their life. Is this a defining decade for them?
I'm Peter Adopoulos. I'm a sophomore at George Washington University.
Peter doesn't really have a firm idea about his future right now. He's thinking about becoming a teacher. Do you have a plan B, like if the teaching thing doesn't work out?
No, not at all. No. No.
In 8 years, I'll be the age that my parents were when they had me.
This is GW student Robert Rinaldi. He's 20 years old.
I can't imagine being mentally or financially prepared in 8 years to start a family.
Exactly.
But, like, I feel like I need to.
We walked over to a local restaurant where a lot of students and recent grads hang out. There we found Emily Hofstetter.
I'm 20 and I'm from Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
She works here part-time as a hostess to help pay for school.
I'm an English and theater double major. I'm totally willing to do the whole theater and waitressing thing, you know, as long as I can call myself a theater person first. It's hard with the economy the way it is. You kind of just have to, like, roll with it and do whatever you do, but I guess you never know.
Inside, sitting at the bar with some friends, is 23-year-old Garazi Zuleika. She currently works at the Department of Justice in what she describes as a real job. But while she's got a plan mapped out for her career, she says planning out a personal life doesn't work.
I think that, you know, when you're little, you have timelines. You say, like, I want to be married by this age. I want to have a kid 2 years later. I want to have this stable career. And then it just doesn't work out that way. I'm 23. I'm going to grad school. I'll be pulling out, like, $100,000 in loans. And paying that back is a long-term commitment. Knowing when I'll be able to afford to have a house or a marriage or a child is just not something I can foresee today.
So no rush?
No.
These are the voices of young 20-somethings.
For people in their mid to late 20s, the pressure to make big decisions about work and relationships gets more intense, as do the consequences of those choices. Clinical psychologist Meg Jay of the University of Virginia calls this chapter of life the defining decade, and that's the title of her new book. We recently spoke with Jay about what exactly she thinks is so critical about this particular time. Her response?
Everything. We know that...
That's a lot.
It's a lot. Get ready. We know that 80% of life's most defining moments happen by age 35. We know that 70% of lifetime wage growth happens in the first 10 years of a career. We know that more than half of Americans are married or are living with or dating their future partner by 30. Our personalities change more in our 20s than any other time. Our fertility peaks. Our brain caps off its last growth spurt. So our 20s are a time when the things that we do and the things that we don't do are going to have an enormous effect across years and even generations. And too many 20-somethings don't know this.
We should say that 20-somethings, that whole demographic, it's a diverse group.
Very.
And, you know, there are people who are married homeowners in their 20s. There are people
Absolutely.
With successful careers or the seeds of a career. But as far as you have been able to tell in your research, are there any patterns traced to a person's childhood that shape how he or she will navigate their 20s?
No. And that is what I really love about working with 20-somethings. Some people have it easier than others, of course. But if there's ever a 10-year period when you're going to transcend your childhood, it's going to be the 20-something years. So I've worked with clients from the most disadvantaged backgrounds who drum up one good letter of recommendation, and then they head off to a great school or a great job. I've worked with clients with the saddest family histories who grew up chanting, "You can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends." And then in their 20s, they transform their lives by picking and creating good families for themselves. On the flip side, I've seen 20-somethings who've had every advantage, but who blow it and fall very far from where they grew up. So the 20s are really an inflection point when life is up for grabs.
You have a private practice in Charlottesville, Virginia, and you have a lot of 20-something clients, patients. I wonder, what are they telling you behind closed doors? What is today's average 20-something concerned about? What's keeping them up at night?
Facebook.
Facebook.
You know, 20-somethings are worried. They're anxious. They're worried about whether life is going to work out for them, whether it's going to work out as well as they thought it would or they hoped it would when they were kids, whether it's going to work out as well as it's working out for the next person. But the thing to do about that is to realize that my 20s are really the time to make my own certainty and to make sure that, yes, my life is going to work out because I'm starting to put the pieces together in an intentional way.
So, you know, when you're giving advice to 20-somethings who are feeling kind of stuck, is it just about being able to look to the future and not get bogged down in the present?
There is a lot of that. 20-somethings are very prone to what's called present bias. So are all humans, which is what procrastination is about and oil consumption and overspending. It's when we think about the now and we don't think about the later. I think thinking about later is very scary for 20-somethings because they don't have a lot of experience doing that. So a lot of what I do with clients is not give them advice as much as ask very pointed questions about what is it that you want? Where would you like to be in 5 or 10 years? Do you want to get married? Do you want to have kids? What do you want your job to be? What do you want your life to look like? These are questions that no one asks 20-somethings because they know it scares them. But deep down, 20-somethings want people to ask them these questions because they know they need to figure it out.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Meg Jay is a clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Virginia. Her new book is called The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. She joined us from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, Virginia. Meg, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And all the free advice.
We're talking about picture books this week, and for a certain set of readers, one need only say the word pigeon to set off a frenzy of delight.
Pigeon is the star of a series of best-selling children's books that began with "Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus." Pigeon is not much more than a stick figure with a couple of circles for eyes who can get huffy and display all the melodrama of a 4-year-old.
Mo Willems created Pigeon. His latest book is The Duckling Gets a Cookie. It features an oh-so-adorable yellow duckling. And notice, Pigeon is not in the title. One might not even know he's in the book.
Yeah, and that makes it even worse for him. You know, these are not funny books to the pigeon. These are tragedies. So on the first page, I think the pigeon says, I do not like the look of that title.
Yeah, that's the first. So you really meet Pigeon first. And tell us about Pigeon.
He is the only creation, the only character I've ever created that I didn't create. I really wanted to make children's books. I wanted to make picture books. So I spent a month in Oxford, England, thinking it would make me smarter, and it didn't. And I made all these really terrible books. And in the margins, I started drawing this pigeon who was complaining about the other books, who was saying, don't write about them, write about me. I'm funnier. Stop this. This isn't funny, that sort of thing. And so eventually I gave in and I turned him into a sketchbook that I give for clients and friends. And sort of by accident, this got into the hands of an agent. And, you know, now look at the mess I'm in.
Well, actually, that sounds like what we sometimes hear from novelists, that their characters take on a life of their own and actually force them into some sort of path that they maybe didn't expect.
Absolutely. And you know, the pigeon ends up in the back of every book or somewhere hidden in every other book that I do. And he just hates it when I'm not writing about him. And so I always have this constant sort of pecking on the side of my head saying, when are you going to make a book about me?
Well, this is theoretically about Duckling. Right. And who is Duckling?
Duckling is really the sweetest, kindest, most adorable little duckling. Duckling gets everything, and Pigeon doesn't. It's just part of another injustice that is around the pigeon. He doesn't get to drive the bus. He doesn't get to stay up late. And now he has to deal with this super cute, adorable thing that seems to be getting all the attention.
Let's read just a little bit of The Duckling Gets a Cookie. Now, I couldn't even begin to think about being Pigeon, but I could probably take on Duckling.
Oh, that's great. You would make a great Duckling. Do you want to start at the beginning?
Sure. Hello, Scooty, Scooty, Scoot. May I have a cookie, please?
And suddenly, magically, a cookie comes into frame. Whoop.
And so Duckling's got a cookie and says, oh, thanks. That was very nice of you. Oh, look at all those nuts.
And hey, how did you get that cookie?
I asked for it.
You asked for it?
Politely.
Hey, does that cookie have nuts?
Yes.
So, you got a cookie with nuts just by asking?
Politely.
I ask for things all the time.
It goes on. But for the part that I gather children will join in, and it's the big No.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, part of it is when you're a little kid, it stinks. The furniture is not made to your scale. You can literally, if you're having fun and somebody wants you to stop, they can lift you up and fly you into another room. They can take you away. You have to ask permission to go to the bathroom, you know. And so here, I think, is the chance for you to stick it to the pigeon. Because that's, it's just human nature. We, you know, if we're being trodden down, we're really looking for an opportunity to do it to somebody else.
Well, you know, your work, you engage with the big issues, loss, injustice. And it seems like in one book, and this isn't one of the pigeon books, this is Elephant and Piggy. One in that series is We Are in a Book. And it seems mm-hmm. that you're engaging there with death or one's own end.
I probably am. I mean, Elephant and Piggy are, sure. You know, this is the great thing about writing for kids is the things that really matter to us as humans are heightened in a kid. You know, it's love, it's jealousy, it's justice, it's wanting to drive a bus, these core fundamental philosophical issues.
Yeah, like wanting to drive a bus. That's definitely a core fundamental issue.
Definitely. No, I mean, that goes back to the Greeks.
Tell us about We Are in a Book. The premise is they've discovered they're in a book.
It's self-awareness, yes.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful thing for them. They discover they're in a book. And so, like anybody who discovers they have power, the first thing they want to do is manipulate that power. So they're going to make these young readers say the word banana, whether they want to or not. Then Piggy says to Elephant, well, do you want to come up with another game that we can play with these poor innocent readers before the book ends. And it's the first time that Elephant realizes that, that books end and the pages are going very quickly. So he flips out.
But I'm not sure I want to give anything away. But you figure out a way to resolve
it. There's a solution. There has to be a solution. Yeah.
You have a long relationship with writing for television. You won 6 Emmys for your work at Sesame Street. And that kind of writing shows up in your books, it seems, not just funny, but also really works. And it's very possible to read it out loud. Do you read out loud as you're writing?
I think it's really important. I mean, here's the weird thing is I write for illiterates. So that's an odd thing. Right. So what that means is I am dependent on my orchestra. And my orchestra can be a parent, it can be a teacher, it can be a librarian. But I have to make sure that my orchestra is engaged, that they're, you know, maybe being sillier than they normally are, that they're yelling and jumping around, so that that's what's going to make the book work better. It's very, very important. Also because it's a time to be together. You know, I want parents to be engaged in it. I want them to laugh because then it's cool. I think that sometimes parents forget that they are the coolest people in the world to kids. They're just awesome. So if they're enjoying reading books, suddenly the kid is going to say, wow, reading books is awesome.
Thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Mo Willems. His new book is The Duckling Gets a Cookie. Take a peek at our website.
And later today on All Things Considered, NPR's Backseat Book Club, a series for older children.
The Ukrainian writer Andrei Kurkov has written 13 novels that have gotten him compared to everyone from Franz Kafka to John le Carré. His books first began to be translated into English in 2001 in Great Britain, where he soon developed a devoted following, but he still remained largely unknown in the U.S., but that began to change when Melville House started releasing his work last summer. Our critic at large, John Powers, is a fan and says that Kurkov is the kind of writer you can get hooked on.
When you hear the words Russian novel, you probably picture something big and heavy as an anvil. Yet ever since the fall of communism, we've seen the ascent of Russian novelists who are shorter-winded and jauntier. The most sheerly enjoyable is Andrei Kurkov, who lives and works in the former Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Kurkov writes short, sly page-turners that specialize in what we might call absurdist noir. He's already a cult writer in the UK and Europe. Now, some of his best novels are being released by Melville House, one of those admirable small presses that, in our supposedly globalized age, are helping keep foreign literature from completely dying out in the U.S. Their most recent Kurkov release is The Case of the General's Thumb, a sardonically amusing romp that's well worth reading. Yet the book I suggest you start with, and that may get you hooked, is the 1996 novel that's probably Kurkov's best. It certainly has his best title, Death and the Penguin. Set in the run-amok city of Kiev, it's the story of Victor, a wannabe novelist who lives with his pet, a penguin named Misha, which he began looking after when the local zoo could no longer afford to keep him. To keep himself going, and Misha in frozen fish, Victor takes a job preparing advance obituaries for a local paper. Sounds promising, until Victor's obits turn out to be a kind of hit list. The people he writes about wind up getting murdered. And that's not all. Soon he's looking after the daughter of his dodgy human friend Misha, called Misha Non-Penguin, whose shenanigans get Victor ever more deeply involved with the gangsters who run modern Ukraine. These thugs have their own strange use for Victor's penguin. Now, if you're like me, you may be skeptical of any book about a man with a pet penguin. It sounds too cute by half, like one of those movies where a loner hitman proves his humanity by raising a bonsai or talking to his pet cockatoo. Yet Misha the Penguin isn't a gimmick. Not only is he central to the plot, he's a mirror of Victor's own melancholy soul. Just as Misha is cut off from a sane environment for a penguin, he's been uprooted from both Antarctica and the zoo. So Victor is trying to survive in a city that's become hostile to simply being human. I don't know Russian, but in George Bird's wonderfully readable translation, Death and the Penguin comes across as an almost perfect little novel. Kurkov tells his story in a brisk, surreal deadpan that captures the mental atmosphere of a country that, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has often verged on black comedy. Indeed, since Kirchhoff wrote this book, Ukraine has been through at least one rigged election, had a presidential candidate poisoned with dioxin, staged an orange revolution, voted in a woman prime minister who lost another disputed election to the guy the orange revolution originally threw out, who then tossed her into prison for crimes that other nations don't remotely believe she committed. Meanwhile, the mafia operates with impunity and public services collapse. Remember how Victor got his penguin? That was true. Ukrainian zoos actually did give away their animals. Of course, what's bad for living can be good for literature. In conjuring the bedlam of Ukrainian life, Kirchhoff's novels are spiderwebbed with entertaining tricks and double crosses. In the new one, an honest cop goes on a wild goose chase to find the thumb of a murdered general. In another, a desolate husband takes out a contract on himself, then changes his mind, a bit too late. Spinning these yarns, Kirchhoff reveals a level of casual corruption so profound that ordinary people, just trying to get by, can't avoid being sucked into the muck. But please don't think Kirchhoff's work grim. It's not. It's fast-paced and witty and on the side of the angels. For all the immorality that threatens to drown them, his heroes cling, like latter-day Buster Keatons, to the life raft of their personal decency. They may not be able to change the world around them. The forces that run it are too big and too strong. But they can find odd moments of zen-like calm. And more important, perform the small kindnesses that reaffirm their humanity. Like looking after a penguin that wants nothing more than to find its way back home.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com.
We're going to celebrate spring now with a selection from the garden for NPR's Backseat Book Club. Each month, we ask young people to read a book along with us, and this month our pick is Seed Folks by Paul Fleischman. NPR's Michelle Norris tells us more.
Our April book takes us to the heart of the city, specifically the city of Cleveland. Seed Folks takes place in a neighborhood that's seen better days. It's filled with people, mostly immigrants, who live in close proximity but barely share more than an occasional hello. They all stay in apartments that surround a vacant lot that, in the course of this story, is transformed from a smelly junkyard into a lush community garden. That garden in Seed Folks is like a big green magnet. It pulls in immigrants who yearn for vegetables they can't find at local markets. It beckons the wounded who find a reason to live as they watch life sprout from little seeds. And it calls out to the elderly. One example, a caregiver named Nora watches over a longtime neighborhood resident now bound to a wheelchair. She explains what happened when the old listless man first spots people working in the soil.
His arm commanded me to enter. Over the narrow, bumpy path we went, his nose and eyes working. Some remembered scent was pulling him. He was a salmon traveling upstream through his past.
Author Paul Fleischman loved the idea of a garden that would help a fractured community grow toward each other, the way a potted plant reaches for the sun. Ugly as it may be at the beginning, that empty lot is the beating heart of his book.
It's a place people have been dumping garbage for free for a long time, out their windows or from trucks. It's in an immigrant neighborhood that's seen many waves of immigration, as Cleveland has. The reason I picked Cleveland, one of the reasons, it's famous for its high immigrant population back in the 1900s and still today. It's not a place that anybody had ever imagined a community garden, and indeed the founder, a little girl named Kim, has no such plans herself. She just plants some lima bean seeds there in an attempt to connect with the father she never knew.
And she plants those seeds in April. We're speaking to you in the month of April. Now, it may be warm in some places, but in Cleveland, it's usually pretty cold in April.
Yeah, she does not have a garden book at her side. She just is working off of instinct, and it's too early, but she has the good luck to have planted them by a refrigerator, which bounces some warmth off, and they come up.
Each chapter of Seed Folks is named for a different character and told from his or her point of view. As their garden plots grow, their hearts grow bigger. Their world view expands. There are still hard times in this rough little neighborhood, but each eggplant, each tomato, is a little victory worthy of a shared celebration.
The entire sixth grade of Hardy Middle School, located here in Washington, D.C., read the book, and we want to thank their teachers for bringing them to NPR's Backseat Book Club. They had several questions for Paul Fleischman.
I'm Kira Bendel. I'm 11 years old, and I'm in sixth grade at Hardy Middle School.
Hi, you're in the back seat of the car, just like in a real car.
Are any of the characters in Sea Folks based off yourself or people you know?
Well, they are. I should tell you that many people think that authors just cut and paste from real life into books. It doesn't work quite that way. Usually characters are changed, transformed, turned inside out. Old becomes young, male becomes female, West becomes East. Look at Kim. She's a little girl from Vietnam. She's lost her father. I would seem to have nothing in common with her. But my own mother had died a few years before Seed Folks. That desire to make connection with that person who has passed away is a universal, and it came out in that story. I have connections like that with many of the characters.
The title Seed Folks does not simply refer to the work in the garden. It reflects a community bond. In fact, Fleischman said the word Seed Folks came to him before he even started to write the book.
The few words of a title are the hardest words for any author to come up with. My father used to offer my sisters and me $5 if we could come up with a title when he was stumped, and $5 back then was worth about $10,000 now. And we never could, and they're hard. So if you have a great title, it's crazy as it sounds, it's almost worth writing a book just to use it. It's like building a house because you have a lovely doorknob. But I had the word Seed Folks. I'd come across it in the course of researching another book. And it's an old term for ancestors.
Now, we should say that your father is, like you, an award-winning writer and writer of children's books. And I understand that he would read chunks of the books that he was working on with the family. Did you came by this naturally, and I'm wondering if there was ever any other choice for you, if you just knew in that household that you wanted to be a writer, that it was just what you had to do.
No, I didn't know I would become a writer, and there was certainly not an ounce of pressure. But it was also a huge part of my education. I mean, I walked off to school every day, but I didn't realize at the time that my education was really happening at home. Yeah, my father, Sid Fleischman, would read chapter by chapter his books as they were written, and that's how I learned what an opening line sounds like and a closing paragraph sounds like, and the joy of history, the joy of names, the joy of words, of plot, of character, absorbed all that without there ever being a worksheet involved. We also had a hand printing press in the house, so I learned the whole visual side of language, setting type. I'm a very careful, slow writer, and I think a lot of that comes from the care required to be a hand printer, where you, if something isn't spaced out enough, you take little slivers of brass or copper and put them between each letter.
Why did your father have a printing press?
He was writing a book called Humbug Mountain about a traveling printer. And as he often did, we absorbed parts of those books into our household. That's how we came to have chickens as well, from an earlier book.
So are your children learning from you? Did you teach them how to garden when you were working on Seed Folks?
Ah, you assume I am a gardener. But I'm
I thought
like
you were a method
writer,
that if you were writing about gardening that you had to put your hands on the soil.
Let it be known, I'm a terrible gardener. I'm an overwaterer.
I'm sure that someone is doing some sort of psychoanalysis right now. He's an overwaterer. What does that mean?
Well, I love them so much I water them to death, basically. But no, like most writers, I'm an ad hoc scholar. If I write about gardening, I'm capable of going to the library or on the web and learning everything I need to know without necessarily doing it. Although doing it is good. That's how we ended up with the printing press and the chickens. There are things you learn from doing it that you're never going to learn from a book.
Well, Paul Fleischman, may your gardens grow. it's been a pleasure to talk to you. All the best to you.
It was my pleasure.
Paul Fleischman, author of this month's Backseat Book Club pick, Seed Folks. I'm Michelle Norris, NPR News.
From Land to Sea for the month of May, our next book, Heart of a Samurai by Margie Preuss. The story, based on true events, focuses on a poor Japanese boy who is shipwrecked, saved by seafaring Americans, and returns home as a samurai.
And for June, we need your help. NPR's Backseat Book Club is pairing up with the Children's Choice Book Awards to democratize our book pick. Go to npr.org/backseat to find a ballot. Every vote counts, so please get your class, teammates, and friends to vote.
The polls are open until May 5th, and the votes are being counted now. The winners will be announced 2 days later during Children's Book Week, the 93-year-old celebration of kids' literature. We'll pick our June book from one of the winners.